Welcome to the Lynn Rivers Show. I'm Lynn Rivers. The 1857 case of Dred Scott has become synonymous with racism and slavery, but the case is about so much more. Today, in our continuing series of landmark legal cases, we'll look at two cases that deal with bedrock issues. First, Dred Scott, which raises the question of who is a citizen, and then Loving v. Virginia, who can marry. Both of these cases may shed light on the current debate around gay marriage and adoption by same-sex parents. Join me as we trace the development of fundamental rights under the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Joining me to talk about the Dred Scott case and Loving v. Virginia are two friends of the show, EMU political professor Barry Pyle and EMU history professor emeritus Mike Homel. Dr. Pyle teaches political science and has written widely on the American judicial system, and Dr. Homel specializes in 20th century U.S. history and U.S. urban history. Welcome to both of you.
Good nice to be back.
Oh, it's always nice to talk with you. So let's go to Dred Scott first. I mean, if there's any case that exemplifies the reason we're doing this, one where people have heard it and heard it and heard it and may not know what it's about, I think the Dred Scott case is one of them. So Dr. Homel, why don't you give us sort of the lowdown? Who was Dred Scott?
Dred Scott was a slave born in Virginia sometime in the late 1790s or early 1800s. And he was taken by his owner to St. Louis, Missouri, where he eventually was transferred to a new owner, a man who served as a surgeon for the U.S. Army.
This is Emerson.
And, that's right, John Emerson. And that's the beginning.
Okay. There becomes a dispute because he travels with his master. Is that right?
Yes. Okay. Emerson was posted to Fort Armstrong, where Rock Island, Illinois, would be, and then to Fort Snelling, St. Paul, Minnesota, today, and was there with Dred Scott and eventually Dred Scott's family for about 4 or 5 years. Then returned to St. Louis, and then went other places, and eventually returned to Missouri, a slave state.
Now, Dr. Pyle, as he's moving through these states, some of them are free, some of them are not, right?
Illinois is, and the territories were under the Missouri Compromise. So when he was in what is now Minnesota and now Michigan, he was in free territory.
So his argument was, at least he says, that under Missouri law, he should be treated as free. Is that right?
Well, that ends up becoming part of the argument, and it's unclear whether or not Dred Scott actually believed this himself or whether or not his attorneys did. But he certainly behaved as if he had been emancipated. He married while in Minnesota, and
which
slaves
was,
were not allowed to marry at the time.
Exactly, okay.
And had a child, soon followed by another child when they moved back to Missouri. It's unclear why Dred Scott actually returned to Missouri, but eventually the case ends up taking well over 10 years. He sues for his freedom based on the notion that while in Illinois or while in Minnesota, he took with him or acquired some form of emancipation or citizenship.
Does he refer to federal law for that emancipation, or does he say he has it coming under state law?
Well, eventually it has to come under some form of federal law because the suit. It's a very complicated legal history that bounces around in state court, eventually to the Missouri State Supreme Court. And then the case really gets a lot of national attention when it comes to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the first question that Roger Brooke-Taney and the court have to answer is whether or not Scott actually has standing to sue. And the only reason he would have standing to sue in federal court is if he was a U.S. citizen.
But I'm going to go back to you, Mike.
Yeah.
Isn't he arguing that there is something in Missouri law that he can rely on for this idea of emancipation?
I don't believe so.
Okay. Okay. I thought Missouri. It was that he was saying that Missouri wasn't following its own law or wasn't.
No.
Okay. Well, we'll just leave
the
that.
The Missouri courts. Eventually, the High Court in Missouri dealt with it, saying no, you're a slave under Missouri law.
So where did Dred Scott or his attorneys get the idea that he could claim emancipation, or he could claim freedom.
His residence for a number of years in a free state, Illinois, and a free territory, Wisconsin.
Okay, but he originally argued that to Missouri, is that right?
Correct. And in a circuit court, lower court opinion, they actually granted him his freedom, and that's what caused the case eventually to work its way up to the Missouri State Supreme Court.
That's right. So it was a Missouri state decision initially.
And there was common law that existed. It was British common law. Written by some very famous jurists, that when a slave moved from the Caribbean to Great Britain, while that particular individual, I believe her name was Julia, was in Great Britain, she was a freed individual. And then the common law also determined that once she moved back into the Caribbean, she became a slave again. And that was part of what Dred Scott's attorneys were arguing eventually.
This is the Lynn Rivers Show right here on 89.1 WEMU. And today we are talking about the Dred Scott case. Later on, we'll be talking about Loving v. Virginia. And my guests today are EMU political science professor Barry Pyle and EMU history emeritus professor Mike Homel. All right. So we're talking about Dred Scott. We sort of have at least the dispute in mind. But once it gets to the Supreme Court, it becomes about a lot of other things. So Barry, why don't you sort of lay out the legal issues for us?
Well, legally, the threshold hurdle that needs to be leaped over is whether or not Scott can actually be at the U.S. Supreme Court under diversity of citizenship. Under diversity of citizenship, you have two citizens of two different states who can file a suit in federal court. Scott, in order to have even the ability to be in federal court, would have to establish some form of citizenship. So that becomes one of the threshold issues for the court.
Because in Article 3, in the cases and controversies part of that, there are specific situations where the federal courts have jurisdiction.
Correct.
And one of them is a diversity of citizenship.
Right. Because at that point, the U.S. Supreme Court would then be applying common law and even Missouri law and potentially, I think as Scott's attorneys wished, Illinois law and the Missouri Compromise.
Okay. So we get there. And, well, even before we talk about that, let's talk about the court at the time, particularly Roger Taney. Michael, why don't you give us sort of a feel about the Chief Justice?
Well, first let's look at the whole court, and then we can talk about Chief Justice Taney. The court in 1857 had 9 people, just as it does today, although that number fluctuated in the 19th century. The justices had been either mainly or exclusively appointed by presidents who were Democrats and Southerners. And
they were synonymous at the time.
Well, not really. Okay. A lot of Democrats in the North. In fact, I think a couple of the Democrats on the court were Northern Democrats. So, largely Democratic court, generally sympathetic to the South. Justice Taney was a longtime veteran of American politics. He had served in the Andrew Jackson administration back in the 1830s, and he was appointed to the court by Jackson way back in 1835. So he had been on the court for 22 years and was 80 years old, but was regarded as a distinguished and respectable member of the court and of the American political order.
So do you think that the vilification that has followed the Dred Scott decision sort of through history about Taney, do you think that was fair?
Well, the vilification has to do with a couple of things, I think. One is Taney's overt racism in the case. Maybe we can quote some of that later.
Yes.
And Taney clearly was someone who had come from a slaveholding family, had really no sympathy or empathy for African Americans, believed that they were inferior and that slavery was proper, and lots of other Americans did. The other source of vilification were arguments about his craftsmanship and his legal reasoning in the case, which is what we'll be tangling with. And with that, I think, you know, maybe most legal historians, at least that I've read, tend to be critics of Taney, but there are others who will make an argument that that one could sustain the logic of what Taney did, as we'll see.
Okay, so we've set the scene. Judge Scott is making his argument that he should be allowed to bring the case.
Yeah,
Michael.
Yeah, well, one other thing before we get to the case itself is I think it's appropriate to talk about the context of it, the political context of it, and you know what's going on in the years before 1857. First, you have the issue of slavery. Slavery is protected under the Constitution. The federal government can't uproot it from the federal level, but there are a lot of people in the North who think it's an abomination and should be wiped out, and they do what they can within the limits of the legal system
right.
to make that come about.
And the slave trade has been ended.
The slave trade was ended way, way back
right.
in 1808, as the original Constitution did provide. So that's one thing. Secondly, you've got the issue of fugitive slaves crossing state lines and efforts by northern states to interfere with the federal law, the fugitive slave law, by throwing up a whole legal barriers.
Well, the Constitution, Article 4. Says that northern states were required to return runaways.
Yes,
slaves.
And northern states defied
right,
that.
Right.
So we talk about states' rights and success mm-hmm. and so on. Okay, the last thing and probably the most explosive is the issue of the expansion of slavery into the territories. And I'm not sure how much time we have to really deal with the history of that, but basically for most northerners or many northerners, they were alarmed at the expansion, the possible expansion of slavery into the new territories that in the West that had not yet become states for a couple of reasons. One is the political balance between the North and South was very even. And if there are new slave states, that affects the political balance, particularly in the Senate. Secondly, a lot of white Northerners, not just political leaders, did not want the expansion of slavery into the West because they did not want to compete with slave labor. They wanted free labor, and if slavery was there, free wage labor would be at a disadvantage. And that is an animating force behind the founding of the Republican Party. And that's an important element here, too, because Republican Party is created in 1854, 3 years before this case, as a party devoted to to stopping expansion of slavery to the new territory. So that's where all these issues are laying behind the legal stuff okay. that we're going to be.
Well, and you mentioned the political environment. Barry, there's this suggestion that Taney and Buchanan, President Buchanan, are sort of whispering to one another about this case and what's likely to come out of it. I mean, were there going to be political ramifications for Buchanan if it went the other way?
Oh, there were political ramifications for everyone. This case drew national attention like few others had this early in the Republic. You know, McCulloch versus Maryland, Marbury versus Madison, it ranks right up there with one of the big ones. And this was dealing with the unsolved issue of slavery. It was dealt with, but not solved at the Constitutional Convention.
It was
always being kicked down the road. And you know, as we've discussed on this program before, it's a very difficult issue that doesn't have a readily solvable problem. And it was coming to a head at this point in American history.
Today we are talking about the case of Dred Scott, a well-known case, but oftentimes not completely understood by people. We're going to talk a little later in the show about Loving v. Virginia. And my guest today, EMU political science professor Barry Pyle and EMU history professor emeritus Mike Homel. Now, gentlemen, we were talking about sort of the lay of the land politically in the country, the fact that this was a huge, huge case. Barry got us to the point where we're in front of the Supreme Court, and the threshold issue is, can Dred Scott actually make his argument before the Supreme Court? Can he get the Supreme Court to address his problem? And Barry, what's the answer?
Well, the answer is long, it's drawn out, and while Dred Scott may be a famous case, it's one that's probably hardly ever read. As soon as you begin reading it, you quickly learn that it's going to take 20, close to 100 pages to come to any sort of conclusion. But in this 250-page tome from the U.S. Supreme Court, they go through a number of issues, and that first one is, was Scott considered to be a citizen among we the people at mm-hmm. the founding of the U.S. Constitution? And this is Taney's first sort of foray into what he believes to be the threshold question of whether or not Scott can actually sue before the U.S. Supreme
Court. So this is
Court.
An argument of originalism.
Yes. And it is bold-faced originalism. And Tawney goes through, and if you actually are patient enough to read through the case, he actually drags the American public and the American legal fraternity at the time through basically America's dirty laundry as it relates to slavery and racism.
Well, I mean, there were multiple opportunities for the Congress to deal with this. First, when the Constitution was written, when the Bill of Rights was written. I mean, isn't Tawney right in saying that, look, you know, we haven't done anything to give him citizenship. It wasn't there at the beginning. Everybody knew it.
Well, this is the irony of Dred Scott, and there's plenty to criticize Tawney for. He is, and in the text of the opinion, he is bigoted. It is clear that he has racist or racial overtones. However, the fact remains that the U.S. is founded on slavery. I believe Barack Obama called it, as well as many others, the great original sin. And Tawney lays it out for all of us and pulls us through. Tawney begins by talking about anti-miscegenation laws, which I know we're going to talk about with Loving. But all the way back to 1691, he sort of lays out all of these laws across all of the states. In fact, he picks on states like Connecticut, Massachusetts, and New York, who also had anti-miscegenation laws at the time.
And had slavery for some time.
And had slavery at times. And he moves through the Declaration of Independence, claiming that nobody believed that Thomas Jefferson believed that that all men were created equal, included African slaves, although I know some historians disagree with that. And then leads through the Constitution and arguing that, you know, the Southern gentlemen who were there at the convention, you know, there was no way that they had intended to include people like Mr. Scott as citizens of the United States.
And the delegates from the South made it very clear that any undermining of slavery meant they were out the door, they were out of the Union.
And then Tawney brings up the 20-year ban on the importation of slavery. He brings up the fugitive slave portions of Article 4. You know, how the early Congresses and early states dealt with the issue of slavery. It is not a pretty picture.
Mm-hmm. Mike, you wanted to jump in.
However, all that being said and all that being true, we were a slave society. There was slavery in the North as well as in the South in the 18th century. Nevertheless, there were free African Americans, both North and South. And in those cases, those people had the right to contract. They had the right to marry and various other legal rights. And in a number of states, those people also had the right to vote. So how does Tawney, and this was pointed out in the dissent in the case, so how does Tawney deal with that?
All right, go ahead.
Well, he deals with it fairly easily. He deals with it by going to what we call in the legal field and political science, for lack of a better term, dual federalism, that states make separate decisions from the national government, that the two are independent within the sphere of their own authority.
And wouldn't that be like gay marriage right now?
Exactly.
That states can choose to have gay marriage, the federal government and the Constitution don't recognize it, require it, or reject it, though federal law rejects it at the moment under DOMA.
Well, except the 14th Amendment wasn't in effect in 1857.
Right.
and it is now.
We can talk a little bit about that, and that's probably an extension of Loving. But what Tawney did is he simply said, a state can decide to make who they choose to be a citizen a citizen. But what a state cannot do is make a citizen of a state, a citizen of the United States.
Right, right. I want to make sure people recognize that they're listening to the Lynn Rivers Show here on 89.1 WEMU. My guests today are EMU Political Science Professor Barry Pyle and EMU History Professor Emeritus Mike Homel. We're talking about Dred Scott, and we're going to be talking about Loving v. Virginia a little later on, which is a miscegenation case, a law in Virginia that forbade interracial marriage. But we've got this situation at the Supreme Court. The argument is citizenship. And Michael, I want to go back to you because I don't want to be sympathetic to Tawney. I don't want to be sympathetic to his point of view personally. But legally, I think, where was he supposed to find the statement that in sort of the federal constitution, where was he supposed to find the statement that that slaves were citizens? I mean, we couldn't just say out of the blue, we say.
Oh, that's, well, actually, I don't think the Constitution has a clear pronouncement about that. The Constitution is quite elusive about slavery, doesn't really mention slavery by name, and only mentions it in connection with several things.
But it's clear. It may not be written down, but it's very clear to everybody
what the situation is
with slavery.
But, you know, Taney could have gone in a number of other directions. He could have said, well, since Mr. Scott is not a citizen, and since he is a slave, he has no standing here. So, this case is, we will not hear this case, and the Missouri State Court decision stands. Or he could have used a precedent case 5 years earlier, Strader, and just said, that's the precedent. Being in a free state, as the Strader case also involved, does not make you free, and we just affirm precedent. Instead, he did some other things that we'll talk about regarding not only citizenship but also the issue of slavery in the territories.
Well, let's turn to that, Barry. Tell us about what sort of the turns and twists that this case takes.
Well, the turns and twists are fairly simple. Once deciding that the U.S. government, through the U.S. Congress or through the U.S. Constitution, has to make people like Mr. Scott a citizen, and that if Illinois wants to make him a citizen, that's great, as long as he's in Illinois, but he doesn't carry that citizenship across the Mississippi. Once Taney does that, he could have stopped. He didn't stop. And in fact, he goes on to question whether or not Congress could regulate slavery in the territories. And this is where Taney really, he's already stepped in it. We know that he's got major issues with racism and slavery and bigotry. Now he's going to go and attempt to solve what was becoming apparent to many, that there was that the slavery issue was going to come to a head by ruling that Congress cannot regulate property in the territories.
So he says, not only are you not a citizen, Dred Scott, your property, your chattel.
You are chattel, and while in the territories that Congress, under the U.S. Constitution, has an ability to regulate, they may not regulate property or slaves of individuals from the South or individuals in the territories, because that would be a deprivation of property under the Fifth Amendment Due Process Clause.
Well, I know it's not exactly the same, but under Article 4 in the Constitution, with the runaway slave provision, doesn't the Constitution already say that, look, if you have a non-slave state and a slave state law is going to follow that person? In other words, if a slave runs away from a slave state, makes it to a free state whose law recognizes them as free, under Article 4, the first clause, which is now changed, they had to return them. The slave state law trumped the free state.
But that wasn't the case in this situation, Dred Scott. He was not a runaway. He always accompanied his owner.
No, I understand that. But yeah. I meant we already have this idea that in some cases we had recognized the idea that slave states would be able to sort of extend their reach beyond their borders.
Well, but that only applied, as Mike just said,
right,
only to runaways. Dred Scott, being voluntarily taken into a free state, became free. And now the question is, if he's voluntarily taken into a territory, can Congress make him free? Now, this becomes the linchpin of the whole entire issue of whether or not Congress can actually regulate slavery in the territories. Congress had banned slavery in certain territories, particularly in the North, and disallowed the continuation of slavery in those newer territories. Taney said Congress does not have the power to do that because they are depriving U.S. citizens of their Fifth Amendment property rights without the due process of law or without paying for the property they're taking away. And here we're talking about property as people and people as property.
Right.
But isn't it the case that in the past the Fifth Amendment had always due process provision had always been read or interpreted as due process concerning trial? And because Fifth Amendment is all about, you know, all about trial and criminal procedures. And that Taney is reading a whole new meaning into the Fifth by expanding it to property rights.
To takings.
Exactly. So.
Yes.
Also, and that is one of the, if we talk about why Taney is criticized, that's one of the issues on that ground. We'll go on to other things in a moment.
This is the Lynn Rivers Show right here on 89.1 WEMU. We're talking about the Dred Scott case. This is part of our continuing series on landmark legal issues.
Let me pick up on that because Mike brought up a very, very, very important point. Within the modern legal field, there's a phrase called dread again. And it's this notion of something called economic substantive due process, which we've talked about before, that actually creating substantive rights in this procedural right. And I think the one that comes to mind right away for me is Justice Scalia's dissent in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, where he says, abortion rights, Lochner versus New York, and Dred Scott are all related because you're finding substantive rights in the Due Process Clause. And that's one of the major criticisms of Taney's opinion and one of the reasons why it goes on for such a lengthy period of time.
There's a certain irony to the threshold issue being whether or not Dred Scott's request falls under the jurisdiction of the court. And then the court takes off and dicta into issues that they would have no jurisdiction over.
And the dissenters raised that issue, if it's dead, it's dead. You can't now try to solve the problems of the coming potential civil war.
But one of the reasons why Taney took that on, in addition to his own desire that the court settle this big issue and tell the political system, what's what and stop the argument, which it wouldn't do, is this, that Dred Scott's appeal to the court was based on a writ of error that asked the court to settle the issue of slavery in the territories. Then, on top of that, there was originally a draft opinion written by Justice Benjamin Nelson that would have just said, we invoke Strader, this earlier case. That's the precedent, end of case. But two justices who were the dissenters, 7 out of 9 would have just signed that opinion. Two dissenters said, no, we want to talk about slavery in the territories because that's important. And with that, the majority justices said, yeah, we'll talk about slavery in the territories, and you have Taney's work that
don't you have a separate opinion by each of them?
Yes, in fact.
Concurrences or dissents?
This was the first case, first time in American history, the Supreme Court, that there were 9 opinions. Everyone had opinion. It was also, by the way, only the second time in American history that an act of Congress had been ruled unconstitutional, which is also a way to view the Dred Scott is asserting the power of the court. And in so doing,
judicial review.
Exactly. In so doing, unleashing a political storm that we'll talk about.
Mm-hmm. So, at a practical question, why didn't Dred Scott just refuse to leave the free states?
We don't know.
Yeah, I mean that's kind of.
You could think about it this way, and obviously it's all guesswork. If you are Mr. Scott, what do you do? You're away from everything you've always known. He actually, in many ways, he went back to St. Louis. He wasn't held as a slave per se, but he was sold out for day labor. He was oftentimes allowed to roam freely throughout St. Louis. I don't know what he would have done in Illinois or in Minnesota.
He and his wife and child were in Louisiana.
Yeah, for a time.
Louisiana would have recognized his freedom.
Yes, because they did have a provision saying that if you're free in another state, you're free. But actually, when Scott was with Dr. Emerson, he was on these army posts in these forts, and one would imagine in the 1830s, these were fairly isolated places. And Dred Scott was not informed, you know, probably nobody told him of the law of these places. And his life wasn't onerous. He was a slave, but he was a servant on an army post. And so the best guess is that nobody told him, and his life was better than a lot of other African Americans.
So how did the case get generated? I mean, that's the question. You're left with why didn't he stay? And then once he decided to essentially stay in service, why bring the case?
Back in St. Louis, he was placed in the custody or under the authority of somebody who was a relative of his original owner,
the executor of the original owner's estate.
Yeah. And this man was a businessman in St. Louis and an opponent of slavery, and that's where you get the kernel of the case. Then, after it's settled in Missouri, a very important figure in American politics, Montgomery Blair, who later is Lincoln's Attorney General, Montgomery Blair says to the Missouri folks who are pushing this case, I will make sure that the case gets to the Supreme Court and cover expenses and or argue it without fee or whatever. Blair was a lawyer. So you had other people. It was not Dred Scott on his own.
He was along for the ride.
Exactly. He was a willing participant.
Right. Barry, you want to comment?
Well, no. This is one of the early examples of political litigation and actually attempting to use the courts to make a decision. And something we do very commonly today, numerous litigants before the U.S. Supreme Court have little or nothing to do with their actual case. It's been taken over by attorneys and moneyed interest and people who want the Supreme Court to rule because, as we know from Marbury versus Madison, the Supreme Court equated itself with the ability to interpret the Constitution and actually be the Constitution. This was seen as one way to potentially and slavery.
And very similar to that, this is what's shaping up with the current Supreme Court's hearing the litigation over the Affordable Health Care Act, Obama's legislation. And because each side has a contention, they want somebody to settle it. It's in the lap of the court.
So another irony. It goes to the Supreme Court. And the thought is, we're going to settle this once and for all. We're going to get this nice and clean and done with, and then all hell breaks out on the court with all these different. I mean, you've got different opinions. It's this. It's that. It's this. You've got dissents. You've got concurrence. What can anybody pull from that? Obviously, 7-2 on
that. Yeah, 7-2.
Not much. The opinion rambles on, talking about Roman law, talking about the King of England's perception on vacant lands. It goes on and on and on and on. It solves nothing. And it becomes then the impetus for the passing of the 14th Amendment and the Equal Protection Clause and the 13th Amendment and the 15th Amendment and all of these things sort of come out of, you know, talk about irony, come out of this Taney's attempt to use the Constitution to solve this issue. Eventually involves the Constitution quite literally being changed
as an
to
antidote.
Directly overturn the Dred Scott decision.
But Michael. Even before that, comparing what's happening within the court to what's happening in the country, all hell really breaks out in the country. Is the political system for this reason. The court, by its ruling that overturns the Missouri Compromise and says slavery, Congress can't restrict slavery in the territories, the court is saying that slavery can exist throughout the West. It's saying implicitly, although not yet explicitly, that possibly Congress cannot or states cannot prevent slavery from entering any state. And by so doing, it's saying to the new Republican Party, your main position, your main platform against slavery in the territories is legally untenable. And it also splits the Democratic Party, which had been a party both in the North and in the South. It splits the Democratic Party in two along sectional lines, paves the way for the election of a minority president in 1860, not racial minority, but political minority, Abe Lincoln, who got, I think, less than 40% of the votes, and the coming of the Civil War. But even before that, Northerners reacted to Dred Scott's decision by saying, this is example of the South's slave power conspiracy, the South's dominance in our political system. We have to resist this. Then in 1859, you've got the John Brown Raid, which made the South say, this is what the North wants. They want slave uprisings, and that creates the combustible situation and the breaking apart of the party system that leads to the Civil War.
Well, I want to go forward with talking about the progeny, the consequences of this and the legal progeny, but before we do that, what happened to Dred Scott after this case was put to bed?
He was quite promptly freed, along with his wife, Harriet, and their two daughters. Unfortunately for Mr. Scott, his health was not good, and a year and a half after he was freed, he died of tuberculosis in fall of 1858. His widow, Harriet, and the daughters survived for some years after him.
We are finishing up our discussion on the Dred Scott case, and we're going to be talking in just a bit about Loving v. Virginia. We were talking about the consequences, or we were just beginning the consequences of this case. Briefly, the historical consequences, Mike, and then, Barry, if you'd talk about the constitutional consequences.
Okay, on the historical consequences, as I said prior to break, the political party system, which had been held together by the fact that you had two parties, the Whigs and the Democrats, both of which spanned the sections. Anyway, that breaks apart. And so you have a new political party based only in the North. Because the Democrats, the majority party, split in 1860, you get this minority party that wins, the South bails out, and you have the Civil War. And once the South is out, then the Congress enacts a law banning slavery in the territories in 1862, signed by Lincoln. And also, once the South is out and in revolt against the United States, you have the enactment of the 13th Amendment, which appears to prohibit slavery and other involuntary servitude. You have the enactment of the 14th Amendment, which we've talked about again and again on this series, due process of law, equal protection of law, and a lot of other things. And, of course, the 15th Amendment on voting rights. So that's the political consequence, is that Tawney is overruled by warfare.
And constitutional change.
Yes, exactly, as Barry said.
Right. Before. And, Barry, I want to turn to you because now my law professor always called the 14th Amendment the Queen Amendment. This was a particularly important addition to the Constitution. Why so, Barry?
Well, I think you can argue that it is revolutionary in many ways, because what it does is it nationalizes many of things that are potentially in the Bill of Rights and in the U.S. Constitution, Due Process Clause. And it begins the process of the nation now attempting to solve those problems that were, as you said earlier, kicked down the road. Now we have to decide, what are the privileges and immunities of the citizens of the United States? What is and what is included in equal protection? What are those due process rights to life, liberty, and property? And when can they be deprived and when can they not? Eventually, we have Plessy versus Ferguson, separate but equal.
Which we've talked about.
Which we've talked about. And then, interestingly enough, you have the Japanese internment cases in the early 1940s, where the court uses the Equal Protection Clause and says racial discrimination, especially when it comes to the due process of law, should never be used except in the most extreme circumstances and should always acquire the strictest of scrutinies. Black says this and immediately says, well, it's a time of war, so of course we have it. But that also opens up the door for the Equal Protection Clause to then be applied after the war is over. We see Brown come very close after the war in 1954. And what happens after Brown is a series of cases where now there's an attempt to equalize the rights of the races in various aspects of life, and one of those is marriage.
Okay, so that brings us to Loving v. Virginia. And I've got a little clip from the opening arguments from the plaintiff in that case in front of the Supreme Court.
You have before you today what we consider the most odious of the segregation laws and the slavery laws. And our view of this law, and we hope to clearly show, is that this is slavery law. When we refer to the law itself, I would first like to bring the court's attention, there is some discrepancy in the briefs, between us and the Commonwealth especially, as to which laws are in essence. They have particularly said that Section 2058 and 2059 of the Virginia Code are the only things for consideration by this court. And those two sections, of course, are the criminal section, making a criminal penalty for Negro and white to intermarry in the state of Virginia. 2058 is the evasion section under which this case particularly arose, which makes it a criminal act for people to go outside the state to avoid the laws of Virginia to get married. We contend, however, Your Honors, that there is much more in essence here, that there is actually one simple issue. And the issue is, may a state proscribe a marriage between two adult consenting individuals because of their race? And this would take in much more in the Virginia statutes. Sections 2054 and 2057 void such marriages. And if they void such marriages, if you were to only decide on 2058 and 2059, these people, were they to go back to Virginia, and they are in Virginia now, will be subject to immediate arrest under the fornication statute and the lewd and lascivious cohabitation statute. And more than that, there are many, many other problems with these. Their children would be declared bastards under many Virginia decisions. They themselves would lose their rights for insurance, for Social Security, for numerous other things to which they're entitled. So we strongly urge the court, in considering this, to consider this basic question. May the state proscribe a marriage between such individuals because of their race and their race alone?
All right, I'm going to turn to you, Barry. That lays the case out probably as well as anything could in just a couple of minutes there. How does Virginia respond to this? We get the plaintiffs laying it out. What does Virginia say? How do they justify this?
Well, Virginia says that the law is based on the rational opinion of the legislature of Virginia that miscegenation, or the marrying between the races, causes social disruption, that it's only done by rebels and by people who want to be revolutionaries, and that it gets kind of uncomfortable here, but that if you look at the lower court decision of the trial court judge, he says, and I'll just read this very quickly, Almighty God created the races white, black, yellow, Malay, and red, and he placed them on separate continents. And but for the interference of his arrangements, there would be no cause for such marriage. In fact, that he separated the races shows that he did not intend for the races to mix. It's almost like Virginia's arguing, look, Almighty God did this, and all we are doing as the Commonwealth of Virginia is upholding what God has done.
Now, there are, 16 states that still have miscegenation laws on the books at this point? In the 1960s. Michael, how many of them were enforcing those laws?
Well,
I mean, Virginia was actively.
Yeah, I think quite a number of them were enforcing.
Of the ones that were left, you're talking about mostly the former Confederate states and some border states, and they were being enforced.
Yeah. And
one way or another.
And just a bit of background briefly. This is such, we're talking about this as a constitutional issue, which is proper. But this is also an explosive issue of intense emotion in American society, particularly among white Americans, but also among African Americans. The sex taboo is one of the greatest taboos in society regarding race. And from time immemorial, this had been used again and again to justify white violence against African Americans, who not only violated that taboo, but were allegedly or perceived violate against it. We can mention, the Scottsboro case and the Emmett Till and all kinds of things throughout history at which even a male alleged overture whistling at a white woman or something like that. So this is something that's really people feel very, very intensely about. And throughout the United States in the 1950s and 60s, relatively few people would have justified racial intermarriage for practical reasons, the ostracizing and all that. So this is a big one. It's beyond sitting on a bus or riding a railroad train.
This is the Lynn Rivers Show here on 89.1 WEMU. My guests today are EMU professors Barry Pyle and Mike Homel, and we are talking now about Loving v. Virginia, which was a case against the miscegenation laws of Virginia. So, Barry, tie us the 14th Amendment into the decision in this case.
Okay. The Equal Protection Clause and the Due Process Clause are both used in the case. The court In comparison to the Dred Scott case, the Loving case is fewer than just like four or five pages long. The court is very clear. They say under the Equal Protection Clause, the state must have a compelling interest or a very high level of interest in making discriminations based on race. And the court is very clear. The state has no reason for discriminating on the basis of race when it comes to the race of the individuals who want to marry.
Was this the first challenge to miscegenation laws?
Not exactly. The actual marrying, yes. But 3 years earlier in McLaughlin versus Florida, the U.S. Supreme Court took on a Florida cohabitation law, which banned interracial couples from cohabitating in a structure in which somebody could spend the night, essentially, is how the Florida.
But if they were married, that would not be enforced, or it was.
No, they had an anti-miscegenation law as well, but this is where the court took up the fact that you were making somebody guilty of a criminal penalty just based solely on their race, and this then becomes an issue in the Loving case, where the miscegenation law is taken on, and it's not just about cohabitation now, but it's about the state, solemnizing a marriage between people of two different races.
Actually, this had come before the court at least a couple of times. Back in the 1880s, there was a case that challenged interracial sex, the court says, well, this doesn't violate the 14th Amendment because it bans sex between whites and blacks and blacks and whites, and so everybody's treated equally. Then in 1955, soon after the Brown decision, there was a case also from Virginia involving a Chinese man and a Caucasian woman, and the court voted to let state law stand in large part because it was in the middle of the Brown versus Board thing, and the court didn't want to take on more sticky wickets.
Well, it certainly seems, though, unlike Dred Scott, where he was sort of along for the ride, as we said, this couple, they loved
absolutely.
One another. They were married. They were challenging this for that, real, so to
absolutely.
Speak.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's a genuine, yeah.
Okay. So the court says no can do. What happens in the face of that? We still have the South. We have 16 states that want to do this. Do they continue? Do they find other ways to enforce this, or other ways to punish people for this?
No, I think, so far as I know, unlike school desegregation, which was evaded by
right.
conscious, ways, organized ways, in those other states where couples, wanted to challenge their state laws, they would win, with Loving being cited as president.
It was just social.
This doesn't mean that these states repealed their laws. They, I think in most cases they didn't, but it's just that they were unenforceable if challenged. And also one other thing, unlike Dred Scott that unleashed a big firestorm in the public and the political system, there was relatively little public negative reaction or reaction to this case in the late 60s, I think in part because a lot of people thought this isn't going to happen very often, and also in the heyday of liberalism and equal opportunity, I think a lot of folks thought government shouldn't mess with this, just as in Griswold.
Let me turn to you, Barry. What does this say about gay marriage?
Well, it's a very difficult question. It depends on how you look at it. People would argue that the Equal Protection Clause in the 14th Amendment was written specifically for African Americans, even though it doesn't precisely say that in the amendment. But an original intentist would say that doesn't then broaden out to cover same-sex marriage. Obviously, people on the other side of that spectrum use Loving versus Virginia as precedent for states cannot make these types of discriminations. You hear arguments all the time that, it's not really discriminatory because all men can marry a woman, all women can marry a man.
Well, that was and the argument with Loving.
But in Loving, the court said specifically that's not the Equal Protection Clause. What the court has been unwilling to do is expand the Equal Protection Clause that far at this point.
Yeah,
and a key thing will be, will the court find that prohibiting gay marriage serves a permissible state purpose.
And that's where we're at.
Well, I want to thank my guests for being here today, EMU political science professor Barry Pyle and Mike Homel, EMU history professor emeritus. Thank you so much, guys.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Listeners, please join me next week for another edition of the Lynn Rivers Show, when we'll talk about the news, politics, history, or a mixture thereof. Radio that makes you think. The Lynn Rivers Show, right here on 89.1 WEMU.